Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's August 18th. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Thanks for tuning in. Currently 62 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. Heber City is reporting 58 degrees at the airport. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Monday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We got plenty of sunshine in the forecast for you today. It's going to be a nice afternoon overall with high temperatures climbing into the mid-80s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing to around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Tuesday, expect sunshine to, we'll call it sunny to mostly sunny skies out there. A few extra high clouds in the sky. High temperatures will continue to warm up big time, folks. So we're looking at highs in the low 90s for our friends in Park City as we go into your Tuesday afternoon. How about high temperatures in the mid to upper 90s for the Heber Valley? So, yes, as that high pressure dome builds in, it's going to bring in more heat for us going into your Tuesday. And that will be the story into your Wednesday as well. We're looking at partly sunny skies for your Wednesday afternoon. Just a few extra high clouds continue to build in. High temperatures will be in the low 90s in Park City. We'll see those highs into the upper 90s in the Heber Valley. Now, starting Wednesday night, those clouds could squeeze out an isolated sprinkle. A better chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms could develop, though, as we head into your Thursday afternoon. High temperatures will start to cool back just a little bit with highs in the upper 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs into the mid-90s for us in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, partly cloudy skies, isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms developing in the afternoon hours. High temperatures will be again into the 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the lower 90s for the Heber Valley. As we move into your weekend, we're expecting this pattern to continue with slightly better chances of scattered showers and thunderstorms, especially for your Saturday and Sunday afternoons. And because of that, high temperatures will remain on the cooler side. We'll be seeing highs in Park City only in the mid-80s as we get into your Saturday. High temperatures will only be around 80 degrees by your Sunday with those chances of scattered showers and storms. And for the Heber Valley, highs will be into the low 90s Saturday, but only in the mid to upper 80s by your Sunday. Let's look at your latest forecast. And ABC 4 Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up this morning on the local news hour, stay tuned. I'll be checking in with Mitch Dumke, one of the partners of the Three Springs, Utah Ranch, with an update on the Oakley Ranch and a recap of last week's workshop. Later on, Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher and Programs Director Heather Sims with an update on the youth sport programs now that school started, and Park City Recreation Director Ken Fisher with an update on the new community center and the closure of the pools, along with some fall sport registration. Taking a look at some local news now, Summit County wants the help of Utah's housing czar to improve affordable housing policy on the east side. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that county leaders met with them last week.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox's Senior Advisor for Housing Strategy, Steve Waldrop, paid a visit to Summit County Wednesday. He toured affordable housing projects with elected county leaders and staff prior to the weekly council meeting. County Manager Shane Scott says Waldrop, often called the state's housing czar, holds sway with state legislators.
From a housing perspective, he's probably as powerful as it gets in the state of Utah, and recommendations coming from the governor's office will come through Mr. Waldrop and his staff.
County leaders say they tried to impress upon Waldrop local priorities, including local control. It's a perennial topic back in the conversation after Scott approved a new and controversial development agreement with Dakota Pacific Real Estate, mandated by a 2025 state law. He told KPCW residents did not appeal that decision. In past legislative sessions, Summit County Council members have felt they're unfairly cast as anti-housing by state leaders.
It's the local control that takes into account the uniqueness of every city, county, local area, that we are different than Delta, Utah, we're different than Logan, Utah, and we're different from the Wasatch Front.
Waldrop spoke to the Park City Noon Rotarians June 10th and said the days of cheap living are over everywhere in Utah, and wages aren't keeping pace as more and more people move to the state.
We have a limited supply, we have more demand than we have places for people to live, to the tune of about between 30 and 40,000.
Scott says Councilmember Roger Armstrong invited Waldrop to visit the county after the speech. Local leaders hope to turn him into an ally and advocate for local control. Here's Councilmember Megan McKenna.
The governor's plan has been primarily the strategy of supply and demand. And so I think it was important for us to show that really doesn't work here in Summit County, and that we really need to have deed restricted units in order to maintain that affordability.
One proactive policy county leaders discussed Wednesday was inclusionary zoning. That's where developers, when they build housing, are required to make a certain percentage of it affordable. Park City and Snyderville Basin require 20% of new housing projects to be affordable, but state lawmakers made those measures illegal in 2022. The West Side policies are grandfathered into the law, but now they can't be changed. There is no inclusionary zoning rule for Eastern Summit County. McKenna says the county would like to create one and found Waldrip receptive.
In the Snyderville Basin, we have about 1,800 units right now that are primarily due to that inclusionary zoning.
Waldrip told local officials more information about future housing policy in Utah is coming this fall. The Summit County Council has meanwhile set a goal to build 1,500 affordable housing units, not including the more than 300 in the Dakota Pacific project at Kimball Junction, over the next decade. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Park City Mayor Dan Worrell plans to let the incoming mayor appoint the new city manager. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has details.
Park City Manager Matt Dias, who has been at City Hall since 2014, announced Wednesday he plans to step down in September to pursue a new role in the private sector. During the Park City Council meeting Thursday, council members and the public gave Dias a standing ovation for his service to the city. Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said Friday she and Dias plan to appoint an interim city manager following the rules laid out in city code. Worrell, who is not seeking re-election, didn't say how soon that may happen. The mayor said the city is also beginning the process of finding a permanent replacement.
It's still to be determined how we go about the recruitment. And I mean, we've only had a couple days here. Our HR director is hard at work figuring out what the best way to do the recruitment is. According to our code, it either has to be appointed before November 4th or not until after the new mayor takes office.
Worrell said she doesn't intend to appoint a new city manager and will leave it to the winner of the November 4th general election, who will take office in January.
I personally think that's really important, that the new mayor has a say in who they are going to be working with. It has to be a really special chemistry between the city manager and the mayor.
The decision will be left to either City Councilmember Ryan Dickey or Jack Rubin, who are each vying for the mayor's seat. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Plans are taking shape for Camp Williams to play host to Utah's nuclear power ambitions. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
The Military Installation Development Authority will pursue a $5 million loan from the state's Energy Fund to begin getting 400 acres of land near Camp Williams ready for nuclear projects. Securing the funds would allow MIDA to move forward its partnership with California-based nuclear startup General Matter to develop the land. The two are exploring projects including nuclear energy equipment manufacturing and uranium enrichment. MIDA is the state agency created to serve veterans and members of the military. It's governed by a board of appointed, not elected, officials. In June, Utah's State Armory Board agreed to lease the land near the Utah National Guard Training Center to MIDA for the next 120 years. MIDA board members voted August 14th to seek the state funds. Executive Director Paul Morris says the agency needs the loan because it has a chicken and an egg problem. General Matter needs a flat site to determine its plans, and MIDA needs money, but it can't bond based on hypotheticals.
So I've been in contact with Joel Ferry in his office, and the legislature gave them $8 million for energy projects. And he's gone to them, talked about giving MIDA, it's like the infrastructure bank we've done, a $5 million loan. For us to be able to start after that on the 58.
We can pay it back.
And then we pay it back.
MIDA and General Matter plan to start with a 50-acre buildable pad, which Morris says will most likely be used for equipment manufacturing, since there are fewer regulatory hoops to jump through.
When they decide to go to that site, then we will issue a bond and repay the loan.
If General Matter withdraws from its agreement with MIDA, Morris says plenty of other companies are interested. But he's confident in General Matter's plans. In June, he told MIDA leaders the company is looking seriously at investing well over $1 billion into nuclear energy in Utah.
What they're looking for is a campus up there. So the manufacturing and the enrichment. The enrichment has a lot of public process to go through and satisfy everybody that it's safe and secure.
Security, Morris says, won't be a concern for a facility on a military base. If or when General Mattar moves toward enrichment, he says the company would answer the public's questions about its safety measures. Enrichment is essentially the process of concentrating uranium. It's a key step to make nuclear fuel. General Mattar is one of four companies awarded contract by the U.S. Department of Energy to enrich uranium. MIDA will next seek a contractor to flatten the Camp Williams land and sell gravel from the site.
How do you make 400 acres and make it flat and buildable for us? And what's the value of the gravel that you might be able to pull out and to offset the cost of doing that?
Morris said the deadline for proposals is October 1st. Meanwhile, MIDA is finalizing its sublease of the land to General Mattar, operating here as Utah Energy. Utah is leaning into nuclear power development as part of its effort to become more energy independent. Last fall, KUER reported the state launched Operation Gigawatt in response to the growing demand to fuel artificial intelligence. The project's goal is to double Utah's power generation capacity, including nuclear and geothermal power. According to the Utah News Dispatch, state lawmakers allocated $10 million in this year's budget to find sites for Governor Spencer Cox's nuclear energy vision. In May, the Utah Office of Energy Development signed an agreement with another California nuclear company, Valor Atomics, to create an advanced reactor in Emery County by next summer. It's intended for research. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Two U.S. fencers were in Park City last week for an Olympic athlete crossover with U.S. ski and snowboard team members. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on that.
The U.S. ski and snowboard team's center of excellence in Park City was filled with the sounds of clashing swords Thursday as ski and snowboard athletes tried their hand at fencing. There are three fencing disciplines, saber, foil, and epee. Each has slightly different uniforms and swords, but for Thursday's demonstration, ski and snowboard athletes donned the trademark screened masks and white uniforms worn by epee fencers. After some coaching from two-time Olympic men's foil bronze medalist Nick Itkin and women's epee team member Ann Sabula, athletes were ready for their first matches. Moguls rising star Ali Masuga and 2022 Olympic aerial skier Winter Venecki were one of the first pairs to face off. Masuga said she always watches fencing during the Summer Olympics, but didn't realize how much went into the sport.
Being that person, like, with the full suit on and the weapon is scary. Like, that's intimidating, even though it's not, like, sharp. Like, you're getting hit.
Venecki said her wrist got tired throughout their match, and she had to switch her grip technique.
Instead of the finger, like, pointing technique, I had to switch to the thumb because my forearm was starting to get tired. I was getting a little loosey-goosey with my weapon.
Sabula said she tried to share analogies with the first-timers, likening fencing to boxing, as both sports involve distance, timing, and feints, deceptive movements used to fake out an opponent.
It was really almost beautiful to see the guys picked up on that immediately. One of them was a boxer, and they timed that initial touch, like, very intuitively as a fencer.
Masuga and Venecki have done athlete crossovers like this before with the U.S. women's soccer team and the Utah Black Diamonds pickleball team. Masuga said it's always fun to experience other athletes' Olympic journeys.
Even though all of our sports are so different, we're all going through kind of the same process. We're all training, we're all competing, and just to meet with other athletes and learn more about their sports, I think is so cool to just kind of see their world of it.
Sabula agreed.
It's nice to come to like a hub like this and immediately have that connection with people and understand that they're on the same, I guess, kind of lifestyle flow of grinding, training, eating, sleeping, breathing, living, and loving your sport.
But the visit wasn't just for fun. It was also to raise awareness of the sport. Sabula said most fencing athletes in North America train in New York or LA, but USA Fencing wants to expand beyond those hubs. To do that, USA Fencing has launched school and club initiatives across the country. That's how Sabula got her start. The high school she attended in New York City had a fencing club, so she tried it out at 15 years old. But her passion for fencing started 5 years before that, when she saw a U.S. versus Russia men's saber match at the Beijing 2008 Olympics.
It was an overtime hit, and he hits it. I thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. It was operatic. He threw off his mask. He's roaring. His teammates, I was like, why is this sport? I've never seen this before. I want to do that on that stage.
Cibula made that dream come true at the 2024 Paris Olympics. During a second crossover event on Friday, Cibula and Itkin also had a chance to try out ski jumping at the Utah Olympic Park. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, last week, Three Springs Land and Livestock hosted a workshop with Summit Land Conservancy that was funded by a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. On the phone with details, I have the co-founder of Three Springs Utah, Mitch Dumke. Good morning, Mitch. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. So maybe start by reminding our listeners what Three Springs Land and Livestock is.
Thank you. Yeah, Three Springs Land and Livestock is a ranch operation in the Summit County area. We have a regenerative ranch where we're focused on soil health, ranching practices that create carbon storage in the land, higher water holding capacity in the land. And we specifically focus on being an education and demonstration ranch. So anyone who is interested in practices that can lead to more profitable ranching operations, to more productive ranching operations, we try to be an open space for transparency and learning for those type of practices. We raise on our ranch grass-finished beef, pasture-raised chicken, meat chicken, and then also pasture-raised eggs. So that's our operation.
Yeah, so how would you describe the difference between what you do in a conventional cattle or agricultural operation?
Yeah, thanks. I would say the most unique difference, if someone came onto the ranch, which we always invite people out to, is that you will notice that there is constant movement of our animals. So when it comes to our meat chickens, they're in an enclosure on the pasture, and we move them every single day to a fresh piece of pasture. Our cows are highly concentrated in a single area of our pasture, and we manage them with electric fence and move them every single day. That goal is about allowing the plants to fully recover before they ever get grazed again. So we're mimicking what looked like bison herds or wildebeest herds, where they would be high-density predator pressure and then move on to the next place, and then those pastures would be ready in 60 to 90 days. So we're mimicking that kind of thing, whereas in a lot of industrial, large-scale agriculture, you have feedlots where the animals don't move much. Chicken houses are insanely huge, and those chickens rarely get to move. And so there's diversity of diet, and I would like to say the full joyness, the pigness of a pig, the cowness of a cow, the chickenness of a chicken, they can fully express themselves in a more natural landscape.
Yeah. So what was your background before launching the ranch? I mean, had you already thought that you would be working in ranching and agriculture?
No. You know, like many of us, if we go back to our family chart, we might know of our history of ranching or farming. For all of us, somewhere in the past, we could have a story of someone being a rancher. But I was spending 10 years in product management for software companies. I was an environmentalist in my heart, caring about the land, and I was trying to do my best to save the land, in my opinion. And the way I was doing it at the time was being a vegan, vegetarian, and not eating meat because meat was bad for the planet. And there's still some who abide by that principle, and I would say large-scale industrial meat operations are fairly damaging to the environment. But I made a switch in 2021, was kind of done being in the career I was in and wanted to do more directly associated with the environment. And ranching, oddly enough, seemed like the best way for me to do that.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you used to be a vegetarian, saying that you wanted to help the environment. So what changed your mind? I mean, what we've often heard that if we want to save water, stop eating beef.
Yeah, that is, you know, and I would argue, I still think there is a lot of logic to that argument, depending on what kind of beef you're eating. But for me, that changed when my best friend, longtime friend, during COVID offered me some of his beef, and I told him that I was saving the planet, so I wasn't going to eat it. And he gave me a video. There's a fantastic TED talk by Alan Savory about desertification and how much of it was caused by humans. And it got me thinking about what we're doing to our landscapes that's causing it, and that we can actually use animals. So there's this relationship between animals and grassland, and they need each other. They just need to be managed appropriately. And it just resonated that that if we don't have the hoof of an animal helping till the ground gently, breaking up the seed bank and providing a lot of manure and urine, then we're missing something. And so the narrative about why it's killing the planet is because cows, most conventional cows go into a feedlot for the last of their life. They're eating heavy grains, corn, soy, and wheat. And when they're eating those things, you know, 70% of the food we grow in this country is actually being grown to feed other animals. And so there's a lot of water waste or water spent on those crops to then feed those animals. And we just try to skip that section of growing all the grain. We say, let's put the cows on pasture. We're not going to have a bunch of humans go out eating our grass. But we have a cow that has this amazing body that can consume this, you know, grassy material and convert it into something that we can eat. And so that's why we leverage these animals to convert grasses into a protein for us.
Sure. And it's been such a dry summer. What does that mean then when trying to raise cattle?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's been a hard summer for, as we talked to our fellow ranchers, it's the biggest thing that we look for before we return our animals back to our original place they might have grazed early in the season is, has the land recovered? Have we seen grass fully come back, showing multiple leaves on it? And it's just taking longer. So we maybe planned for 45-day recovery. In our pastures, we're seeing 60 days, 70 days. And so what that means for a producer is we have too many cattle. In some situations, you might have too many cattle eating too much grass too fast. And so you might be stuck with a decision to either sell your cattle or put them back on grass that hasn't fully regrown again. And if you regraze a plant too soon, you compromise its ability to be resilient in a drought. So you make the situation even worse. There is a fortunate out right now in some regards that if you have to sell cattle, the cattle prices are at an all-time high. And so you can get the best money you would ever get. But that affects your long-term potential of having more cows in the future. So it's been really challenging, especially if you're in landscapes right now where you're on more of a rangeland and you're needing August monsoons to help get that extra boost. That just hasn't happened right now. And so it's tight.
Yeah, and that's what we've seen just this summer are the highest beef prices in the history. Why so expensive?
Yeah, there's a few different factors. like I mentioned with the drought, when there is a drought and nationally but ranchers can't feed all of their animals, then they're going to be selling them off. That happened in 2021, and so a lot of cattle were sold off then, and some ranchers haven't even rebuilt their herd enough to then be able to sell more again. And so there's already a reduced number of cattle being processed generally. And then with tariffs, we have less beef being imported. And the beef we import, usually from maybe Brazil or Uruguay or other places in South America, it's a leaner meat, and so that's where a lot of our ground beef comes from, is from imported beef, and those imports are not happening at the same level right now. And then another variable is that we have what's called the screwworm fly that in Mexico that had been eradicated is showing itself again, and so there's no import specifically from Mexico. And so, you know, we're seeing a great reduction in the amount of beef available in the market, so it's increased the prices.
So you expect those prices to stay up?
Yeah, I'm not the best, you know, futurist when it comes to all that kind of commodity pricing. We don't operate directly in that world. We don't sell our beef into the commodity market. We just monitor it. What it really does for a local producer that does sell direct to consumer that doesn't have the same variability in pricing is it allows the producer to sell direct to customer for the same price they probably sold last year. And the price doesn't look that different than what is being sold at the market. Because usually when you sell direct to consumer, there's a higher quality beef associated with that. There's a familiarity with the producer. And you might be paying a little bit of a premium to get that kind of connection to your producer. At least for our grass-finished beef, it's that way. And for a consumer, they might actually say, oh, maybe I won't go to the grocery store and buy that beef. Maybe it's actually better just to buy from the rancher down the street.
Yeah. Now, I wasn't able to get you on air before you hosted last week's workshop in Oakley, but it was titled Land, Livestock, and Legacy, Planning Your Graze for the Next Generation. So what were you hoping that people got out of this two-full-day workshop?
Yeah, it was a wonderful workshop, and the goal was that functionality of productivity and profitability. And, you know, the average rancher is about 62 years old. They say in the next 10 to 15 years is going to be the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the United States. And that transfer of wealth is primarily in land. And so when you are a generational rancher and you want to pass this land on to your next generation, ideally you're passing it on in a form that it's not in the red, meaning it's not creating a burden and a debt to the family, that maybe it can actually be breaking even, heaven forbid. You know, that's the hope is that we can help educate producers that have been in the business, frankly, longer than we have, about some things that you can do to have a more profitable ranch that a next generation would actually want to inherit, as opposed to, you know, a ball and chain. So that was the fundamental idea, was to do that. And it was really successful. We had 9 students out. We had 2 multi-generational ranches representing, well, 2 of the 3 of our participants represented on their own about 7,000 acres in Summit County that are 4th generation ranchers in the area. And it was amazing to hear them say they're willing to come and they want to learn. They want to learn about how they can do things different. And that's not the common mentality you hear. And so we're grateful for Summit Land Conservancy making these invitations to relationships they have to invite them out and to explore some new practices or some old ideas that maybe have been forgotten and trying them again.
Yeah. All right. And you've got another 3-day course on holistic grazing, monitoring, and finance coming up next month. Tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, so that is going to be September. It's a Wednesday through Friday course, September 14th to the 16th. 17th through the 19th. And that course will cover a little bit of what we did with Summit Land Conservancy. We're talking about what's called planned grazing, looking at your whole available pastures and how to move your animals through it. Also holistic financial planning and ecological monitoring. So how can you look at your landscape and understand if it's getting better or getting worse? And then making plans around that, both in terms of how to move your animals through it and then how to be profitable in your ranching operation. And, you know, you don't need to have a cow to your name to come to this practice. If you're just a glutton for learning and you want to come out and be on the land and learn how a rancher or producer thinks, that is absolutely welcome. It's a very affordable course. It's sponsored by Working Lands Conservation Grant, and they're a great organization that has helped make this course extremely affordable, about $30 a day, usually about $300 a day. And so we're really grateful for them to make that possible.
Nice. Okay. How would people register or find out more?
Yeah. So Three Springs Land and Livestock, our website, excuse me, is threespringsutah.com, the number 3springsutah.com. And they just click on the events tab, and they'll be able to see a list of our upcoming events. And this is actually our last event for the year. We do farm tours, and so you can sign up for one of those, but predominantly our big workshop will be in September.
Okay. And do you have a retail shop where you sell the beef and the chicken and the eggs?
We don't have our own direct retail shop, but we are available in a few locations. Our storefront, we sell chickens through Stock Exchange in Kamloops. We then sell online. You can order for pickup at the ranch on Mondays, at Mill Creek pickup in Salt Lake on Tuesdays, and then we're at the Park City Farmers Market every Wednesday from 11 to 4. And so you can just show up in person on Wednesday at the market and see what we've got, but you can always order in advance for a pickup at that location.
Awesome. Okay, Mitch, I'm out of time. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a good day.
That's Mitch Dumpke, again, one of the partners of Three Springs Ranch in Oakley, Utah. In the studio now with an update from U Sports Alliance, Executive Director Emily Fisher and Programs Director Heather Sims. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Emily, I'll start with you. Tickets on sale for the 45th annual Jan's Winter Welcome.
That's correct. Tickets are on sale. It's our 45th Jan's Winter Welcome, which is very exciting. Saturday, October 25th, 10:25:25. So easy to remember.
Okay, tickets are how much?
Individual tickets are $550 per person. I think there are a couple of tables available. You'd have to reach out to Ashley Loxo, our development director, ashley@ysausa.org.
Okay. And again, this is like the fundraiser of the year for you.
Yeah. So the reminder is that this is the 45th annual Jan's Winter Welcome. It's one event, but it benefits eight different organizations. So we work with our seven partner clubs. They bring in opportunity drawing tickets, silent auction items, and live auction items. And all of that money goes back to those teams at 100%. So we're excited. Our opportunity drawing package this year is a trip to the HF Bar Ranch in Wyoming. It's a four-night stay for four people. It includes guest cabins, meals, horseback riding, swimming, hiking, kids programs, and a $5,000 credit towards activities. So that's the guided fly fishing, shooting, traveling, additional nights if you want to do that. We're really excited about this package. The tickets are $50, and it goes back to whatever team you indicate when you buy those tickets. So 100% goes back to those teams.
Okay, so where is the HF Bar Ranch?
It is in Wyoming, and I know it is a bit of a drive from here, but I don't remember exactly where it is, but it's lovely. It's out sort of in the middle of nowhere. It's a true getaway for families.
Okay, again, people can get their tickets by going online.
Online, yep, ysausa.org. You can buy a ticket and indicate which athlete and which team gets credit, or you can have it go back to the Youth Sports Alliance.
All right. Let's see. Part of this also helps raise money for
scholarships. Yep, scholarships as well. So last year we helped our partner teams raise almost $350,000 through the silent auction and live auction and updrawing tickets. So that money goes back to those teams. And then we raised $264,000 for need-based scholarships for athletes in those partner clubs. So really $600,000 of that income from Jan's goes back to those clubs. So excited to try to beat those records again this year, and we'll see on October 25th.
Okay. People can, or I guess I said participants, can apply for a scholarship now for the upcoming season?
Yeah, so part of that, so that money that we raise at Jan's Winter Welcome, that goes to our Stein Erickson Opportunity Endowment. So those scholarships are to keep students in those seven winter sport clubs, help them pay for their travel and training fees. The scholarship window is open now. It's great if you apply early. You need to apply by August 31st. And this is for the full year of training costs and competition costs. So since we started giving away money, we've given over $1.2 million in the past decade. And again, it's for athletes in one of those seven partner clubs. So Figure Skating Club of Park City, Park City Ice Miners, Park City Speed Skating Club, Park City Ski and Snowboard, Utah Olympic Park, Bobsled and Skeleton, Wasatch Freestyle and Wasatch Luge Club. All of that information is online, ysausa.org. And again, these are need-based scholarships. So these are for athletes who would not be able to participate without some scholarship funding.
And what's involved in applying?
So because those scholarships are larger than our after-school scholarships, families do need to provide some financial information that is submitted to our accountant, and she reviews the information and then indicates level of need. So that is confidential information. We only see what their need level is, and then a couple of recommendation letters from their coaches and an application.
Okay. Anything else?
Nope, just check everything out online. Again, you have until October 31st if you're in one of those seven member clubs to apply for a need-based scholarship.
August 31st.
August 31st,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah, that's Halloween.
Yeah, not Halloween, sorry.
This month. Heather, let's see, after-school programs, when are they going to start kicking off?
Well, registration is already open for this first session in the fall for programs that start right after Labor Day this year because of the school calendar. We had to bump it forward a little bit. So we are excited to offer a variety of programs, including mountain biking, sailing, triathlon, basketball, rise boxing, sim sports, acting, woodwork, fit stop, golf course, skateboarding, zip line, and even dog sledding. So there should be something for everyone, and they vary by school and by school district. But yeah, we have lots and lots of different activities open for kids.
Okay. Anything sold out at this point? Because that some of the popular ones go right away.
Yeah, so our golf program in Wasatch has already sold out. I think that one is, it's at Soldier Hollow, and it's one of our most popular events down there. And yeah, that one I think sold out within just like 48 hours, something like that. So
okay, but still plenty to choose from.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Right. And they're for kids in grades what?
So we have programs. So our Get Out and Play program is for kids through 1 through 5th. And then our Activate program is for 6th through 12th.
Awesome. Okay. And you're also got, tell me about this. You're running a one-day program in partnership with the Lindsay Vonn Foundation.
Yes. So the Lindsay Vonn Foundation, they reached out to us earlier in the year to do one of their programs that they are that they run. And so the Winter Sports School has already been running it. And so we're doing a combined partnership between the Lindsay Vonn Foundation and the Winter Sports School. It's on September 26th. It's a hands-on high-energy workshop focused on building confidence, grit, and leadership.
So can you give us an idea of what's going to happen?
So the kids basically have kind of interactive activities as well as leadership exercises and just kind of a mentoring for the kids that are for the kids at the winter school to give to our younger kids.
Okay, is there a cost involved?
It is, but it's very limited. I believe it's like $10.
Okay. Again, people can get more online?
More online at ysausa.org. And that is an Activate program, so they would need to choose the Park City School District. And yeah, like I said, it's Activate.
Okay, let's see. You're also launching a pilot program in 4 Salt Lake schools this fall. Don't have enough to do. Huh?
Well, thankfully, based from last year, Emily met with Mayor Mendenhall when she went to the Olympics, and Mayor Mendenhall was very excited about our programs on the Wasatch Back and was asking about bringing them to the Wasatch Front. So we have 4 schools that Mayor Mendenhall has indicated that she would like to bring programs to. And they are all Title I schools, so they're 3 elementary and 1 middle school, so that's Parkview, Mountain View, Edison, and Glendale. Our programs start there again in September, but we have already a program up at Solitude with some downhill mountain biking. We have a skateboarding program at the fairgrounds, and I heard you talking about fencing earlier, and we have a fencing organization that really wants to be a part of that program down there. So we are very excited, and so now we have programs open to students in Summit, Wasatch, and Salt Lake County. So anybody that would like to join our programs, even if they are homeschool, they can just register at ysausa.org.
Okay, is that the plan going forward, Emily, just to increase programming statewide?
Yeah, we have, as Heather said, we've gotten great support through our exposure at the Salt Lake City, Utah 2034 bid process because we're a legacy of the 2002 games, just had some great support about expanding to other parts of the state, other parts of Wasatch Front. So we really feel like we do have a model that's plug and play, and we've had great support to expand that to other areas. We've hired a Salt Lake City program manager and have some other resources that we're using to expand, and we're just excited to get as many kids out and active and using all of the things that make our state unique and get kids involved and off their screens and doing something fun, making friends.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, I just want to say there are scholarships available for our after-school programs. We have 2 tiers. So one is for families that are $120,000 or less, and then for those that are on free and reduced lunch. So if you are interested in any of our programs on the Wasatch Back or the Wasatch Front, please go to ysausa.org.
Okay, ladies, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Emily Fisher and Heather Sims with Youth Sports Alliance. And in the studio with me, with an update from Park City Recreation, Recreation Director Ken Fisher. Good morning, Ken.
Morning, Leslie.
Of course, we have the ground opening, the groundbreaking, I should say, for the new community building in City Park. So construction's underway.
Yeah, they'll be putting up construction fencing today. So that's exciting. And then the demolition of that building will be a week from today. And in the interim, they'll be start working on relocating the sewer line that goes through there. So people will see a temporary sewer line that will kick in around, that will start around the skateboard park and go down the rail, down the trail there, Poison Creek, and connect to the sewer line that's in the middle of the field.
Yeah, so any impacts to the Poison Creek trail there?
No, we will work to minimize that. It should be off the trail. And if there are any crossings or anything like that, obviously we'd make sure that it's signed and has ramps and all that over it.
Okay. And the timeline on this is you hope to have it open for
next December. It should be open. So it's a really exciting project. I mean, obviously I've been thinking back over the years of this, and one of the first jobs I had with the city was I worked out of that building handing out or selling candy and handing out sports equipment where we would staff it. So, I mean, that was back in the early 90s. So it's somewhat bittersweet to see that building come down, but the new building will be unbelievable and quite the community amenity.
Okay, and we've got a final price tag on it of how much?
Just over $19 million. And that's the total project cost. Hopefully we'll come in under budget.
Okay, and does that take care of all of the stuff that you need inside of it as well?
It does, yeah. It's all the FF&Es, all the impact fees, everything.
All right. And then where do the kids go next summer?
We're still working on that. We've been in communication with some community partners, and we certainly will be operating the camp next summer. It's just a question of that location. And I would, we'll certainly have that out by time of registration next year.
Okay. And as of today, all of the pools at the Mark are closed. We had the leisure pool open for the summer.
Yeah, it was open through the summer. Yesterday was its last day. So last night, our building maintenance crew came in and neutralized the chlorine in there. And now we've started to offload that water. That will take a couple of days, and then we'll start the demolition on those pools. So it's exciting, a lot of projects and stuff going on.
Yeah, so you were able though to work on the other side where the lap pool will be, or?
Correct, that project is moving along. If you look out through the fencing there, you can see the forming for the pump house building, slide, rock climbing wall. They've formed up the lifeguard station. So that's moving along, and once we remove the leisure pool, they'll begin digging the two new pools out down by the old leisure pool.
Okay, and the plan to get those both pools reopened is when?
It should be open by May of next year, so certainly by next summer.
All right, so is the hope to get concrete poured this fall?
They'll be working through the winter. The pools are actually, they're certainly concrete in the project, but they are, it's not a traditional, you know, old school pool of cement and plaster. They are aluminum pools, similar to if anyone has been over to the South Summit Aquatic Center, the pool that they have there.
Okay, that helps with any leaks then, huh, going
yeah,
forward?
Yeah, right, helps leaks, and really it's the new way that these pools are built now.
Interesting. Total project cost then on the aquatics portion?
It was about $9 million.
Okay. All inclusive then. Let's see. So without pools, nor a hot tub this winter, any deals on passes this winter?
Well, our pools are always have been closed in the winter, so that wouldn't be a factor. We're not looking at this time to do a pass sale or anything. The facility's been really busy, and we're just going to continue on with our existing pricing. But I will say that we do have ways for people to get discounts. If you work for a chamber business, your company can sign up and you can receive a 20% discount off passes, as well as we have a sliding fee scale for residents that enable them to also get passes at a discount.
All right. And I used to, I don't know if you still do, a pass sale in January?
It's been hit or miss. It depends every year. I'm not sure if we're going to do one at the first of the year or not.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the fall happenings. You've got adult soccer league sign up.
So we've made some changes to our adult soccer league. Historically, it was a team registration where you had to, you know, get all your friends or the people you want to play with and one person signs up. We've switched that now to where we call it the adult social soccer league, and you sign up as an individual and it's $50, and then you're placed on a team, and you get 9 games, and that league will start on the 28th of August. So I encourage you to quickly sign up. And really, it's a great way to meet new people in the community. It's a model that our ice arenas used for a number of years. And it's helped with, I'll just call it, some of the chippiness that can happen in a league when, you sign up and you're playing against the same people all the time. So we did it this past spring, and it was very successful.
Awesome. So it's co-ed and outdoors?
It's co-ed, outdoors. We'll play out at Quinn's. So, sign up. And the games are at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, so they're not too late either.
Okay. You've got a new fitness schedule coming up for September, and we'll be offering more morning and evening classes, huh?
Oh, yeah, more morning and evening. Just looking at the schedule, we're going to have 48 classes scheduled a week, and that's about 18 classes more than our current offering. So it's a significant change. And we have added some morning and evening classes and, a whole variety of fitness options for people. And then also, if anyone's out there that's interested in being a cycling instructor, we do need some cycling instructors.
Okay. And you've got the tennis bubble going up as well soon?
Yeah, tennis bubble goes up third week of September. So we'll, get the indoor play going there. Again, it's hard to believe. Seems like we just took it down and we're putting it back up again.
All right. And what's the latest on pickleball courts out at Quinn's? Is that happening still?
We're still working on that. Hopefully we'll be going to council. We're shooting, I think it's either next Thursday for hopefully approval of a memorandum of understanding. So
okay, with a private developer,
yeah,
right?
With a private developer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, anything else you want to mention?
No, I would just encourage people to check out our new fitness class offering, sign up for soccer, and enjoy the weather here in Park City.
Okay. Ken Fisher is the Recreation Director for Park City Municipal. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
And Park City Municipal, of course, a financial supporter of KPCW. The Park City Mountain Mediation Center is set to host a conflict transformation workshop this Friday featuring internationally recognized mediator and author Chad Ford. Ford, known for his 2 decades of peace-building work in the Middle East, now serves as an associate professor at Utah State University and will bring a wealth of real-world experience to the workshop. The event is tailored for both individuals and organizations. Ford says participants can expect a hands-on workshop.
This workshop's set up in a pretty intimate setting. We're going to have lots of time for participation, exercises, like I said, role play. Don't come expecting to be lectured to. They'll be occasionally talking about concepts and helping us understand those concepts. But I find that you understand the concepts best when you practice them and when you try to apply them to real-world situations in your own life, and that's what we're going to try to do.
And something to watch for, he says, is noticing patterns.
We typically experience conflict as happening to us instead of it is, again, a pattern that we are engaged in. And we're going to have to spend some time because it is really challenging sometimes to be able to see our part in the pattern. It's easy to see others, but it's really hard to see our own.
The event will be held at the Blair Education Center at 900 Round Valley Drive, starting at 8:30 a.m., running to 12:30 p.m. Tickets are $150, a link to buy, or for more information is online at kpcw.org.